Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen Gallagher is the director of the Milwaukee Institute here in town. And I'm Tim Keene.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angels Investors. And this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
Today on the show, Fred Foster, founder and CEO of ETC, Electronic Theater Controls, based in Madison, Wisconsin.
Today, ETC does lighting controls for theaters and entertainment venues around the world, but it started in the proverbial or literal dorm room at UW-Madison. Fred was 18 years old, and he pitched his idea for a lighting console to Gilbert Hemsley. Hemsley was not only a professor at UW-Madison, but also a production supervisor and lighting director of the New York City Opera.
Getting Gilbert's attention was a challenge for anyone, and especially as a freshman in a department that had 160 undergraduates and about a dozen graduate students, all who got Gilbert's attention well ahead of ours. And we had the idea of building a computerized light board. There was one at the university that was installed in 1973 for $150,000, and my brother, who's a couple years older than I am, and one of his high school friends and one of our buddies from sailboat racing got together and said, we should do this. And my brother took one look at this thing and said, gack, this is disgusting. We can do it for $5,000. So we went over to Gilbert's house, made an appointment to see him at a Christmas Eve party, and Gilbert threw great parties, and eventually we had an opportunity to meet with him and whoever happened to be in the room, and we said, we're going to build a Q-file, which was the name of that earlier computer, and everyone around the room looked at us and said, yeah, sure. So that kind of pissed us off and gave us the reason to keep going.
That's where Gilbert Hemsley's expertise and his teaching style came in.
Gilbert was a mentor in really an artistic sense, more than a business sense. As one of the beauties of his program and the way he taught was he took his students out when he worked professionally. So in my first year of school, I got to spend 2 weeks in New York City when he was lighting two operas at the Met. And basically, I got sandwiches for the design table, but I got this is when I fell in love with opera houses.
But Fred says when he started out, he and his brother didn't think of themselves as entrepreneurs.
We started with a goal of building a computerized light board. Our original fantasy was we were going to sell it to a company for $150,000 and be rich for the rest of our lives. That didn't turn out to be true. But I don't think our motivation was to build a business or to command, control, or lead the market. We just had an idea that we wanted to do. It crossed a bunch of the passions of my brother doing the software, Gary doing the hardware, me doing the lighting, kind of product, what would be product management, I guess. And Jim Bradley was involved as well. So it was, we were young, it was something to do, and I guess that's how it started.
So let me go back to Gilbert for a minute. If he had 160 or 200 students, mm-hmm. he certainly couldn't spend the kind of time he spent with you guys with everybody.
He didn't actually spend that much time with us. I mean, we from the Christmas party in 1975, it was a year and a day later on Christmas Day of 1976 when we dropped our first computer down on his coffee table at a party, which is arguably the same party that was going on the whole year. And we set this down, and the general reaction of a lot of the people who were still – who were there, who were also in that first meeting was, oh, you've done it. Now what are you going to do? And by this time, I'd worked at the Met, and I smiled broadly and said, we're going to sell it to the Met, which was a total pipe dream. But where Gilbert reentered is that he had arranged a production of an opera that was put on by the Madison Opera Guild. It was Manon. And it was going to be the first time that an opera was shown live on color television, on public broadcasting. It was broadcast on stereo radio because there was no such thing as a color stereo television, and there was going to be a live audience. So this was the first time that had been done, and they decided and agreed to use our computerized light board because that would make Gilbert's show even bigger, because arguably a lot of this was about Gilbert. And so at this production, while it was rocky getting it going, there was a man named Clem D'Alessio from the Metropolitan Opera, and Gilbert brought him back on opening night. and proudly said, and here is a switchboard that my students have made. And Clem pushed one button on it and blacked the entire theater out. Not just the theater, but the dressing rooms and the offices and the lobby. So it's fair to say we didn't get the order. Gilbert knew somebody who worked at Kleagle, who ran Kleagle, which is the biggest company in the day. And he arranged for us to go to a trade show, and we thought we were going to sell the board to Kleagle. And so Bill and I loaded it up into a plywood box and carried it, went down to Washington, D.C. and unpacked it in our room and went to the Kleagle hospitality suite before the show opened. And there in the middle of their the hospitality suite was a computer that did everything that ours did. And we were totally crushed. But we licked our wounds. We went down to the trade show floor the next day and went to the smallest lighting company we could find and said, we have a light board to show you. And here a great man who ran this company called Hub Electric came up. He saw this and he said, you know, boys, this is too big a product for my company, but you should keep going. And that was a really gracious thing for him to do. And I remember it very distinctly 40 years on. Because what he basically did was to give us another kick in the butt to keep going.
They kept at it and eventually got a contract to sell the electronics, the software, and a floppy disk drive to a company for $5,000. The company turned around and sold it for $30,000. But as his schooling ended, his brother and other partners left the company to pursue their own careers, and Fred and a handful of employees were left building lighting consoles in a garage.
And it was a matter of being too stupid to quit.
What really got you on track with the business? You know, did you have any mentors who helped you sort out how to run this business, how to grow it?
I think probably Bob Gilson is one of the people who helped us, and his father, Warren. Bob's father, Warren, started a company called, at that time, Gilson Medical Electronics, now called Gilson Incorporated.
A Madison company that makes instruments for pharmaceutical and biotech companies?
Yeah. Basically, imagine any device that takes a drop of liquid out of one test tube and puts it in a bunch of others. And Bob and his father were very generous with their facilities, inviting all of Bob's friends in on the weekend to use the equipment. And we met Bob through sailboat racing, and the first time I went to his factory was when we had broken the top of our mast off when we tipped our boat over, and he could weld aluminum, and we put it together. But the fact that Bob and Warren would let us use their factory, I'd go in on the weekend, I'd wait in the parking lot until one of them showed up so I could get in, and Bob's way of teaching me to use a machine was, here's a power switch, and then he told me how I broke it. but their generosity was incredible. We couldn't have been in business without his support. When we moved from my brother's bedroom at my parents' house to our first true garage, it was in a building Bob built for us and another one of his friends who was starting a business.
From that auspicious beginning in a dorm room and then a garage, ETC has grown and now has 1,100 employees and is in 10 countries around the world. All of their manufacturing is still done in Wisconsin.
So tell us about that growth curve from three guys in Bob Gilson's shop to today.
The first 2 years, we didn't have any money. We didn't pay ourselves. Then we got the contract, the OEM contract with Colortran, and in about 1978. So by 1983, we were maybe eight people with under $1 million of revenue, so it was a very flat growth curve. But we actually started paying ourselves, which was nice. And then Bill and Gary both continued on with their schooling. And in 1979, we got a deal through Colortran to build a parade control system for Disneyland. And that started a relationship with Disney that now is 35 years old. And it's now to a point when Disney builds a theme park, we basically get an order for one theme park and provide all of the lighting control. And that's because over the years, we've worked with them to develop a special control system really just for them. And we have serviced the hell out of them.
But initially, the competition was rough.
The business had four major companies: Strand, which was owned by the Rank organization in England; Kleagle, which was a perennial leader; Colortran; and then a company called Electro Controls. those four companies made computerized lighting consoles, dimmers, and spotlights. And here we only made the consoles. And we were challenged by this because we would try to bid against the big guys on an entire theater project, and they had a great argument. They said that, why would you want to buy a lighting system from ETC and Lighting Methods Incorporated? Because when the lights blink, they're going to point fingers at each other. But we make the whole system, we'll support the whole system. And as soon as we heard that, I think that that was one of the events that triggered an ethical platform in our company. We knew that we could never let that happen. And so that's why we started 24 by 7 by 365 telephone support. In the early days, it was my home telephone number. But that service ethic has continued to this day, and it's really one of the reasons why we have grown where there are very few vestiges left of the names that I mentioned a few minutes ago.
As his business grew, Fred and his company started to diversify and offer more products. That became easier after ETC acquired the Rochester, New York company, Lighting Methods, after working in partnership with them for a time.
But it also put the combined company in a real money crunch.
So that created a real situation. This was, again, when I learned the business phrase of what a debt-to-equity ratio was. I didn't know this. And it turns out that we had an 8-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio, which is functionally bankrupt. At the time, if you had a 2-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio, your bank executive could loan you the money. If it was a 3-to-1, they'd have to go to the board of directors of the bank. But an 8-to-1 was way out there. Keeping in mind, we had moved 25 people from Rochester to Madison. We had added another 40 people, and we were 85 people at the end of the year. And I had to stand up in front of the company in a company meeting and say, so, we have a real problem. We're almost out of business. We had a plan. The bank approved our plan to work it out, but it required concessions from the employees. So we put in wage freezes, we stopped free lunch on Monday, we kept the free coffee, we needed that. And then we put in the first phase of our bonus plan, because what I've realized since looking back on it is there are times when a company, we had to transfer some of the risk to the employees. And by putting in wage freezes, we were asking them to share some of the risks.
So, and what happened? How many did you lose?
Well, the bonus plan was very simple. We figured out what we had to ship in a month. Let's say it was $800,000. For every $25,000 over the budget, everybody got $5. And that went on for about 3 levels. And then everybody got $8. And everybody got $15. Everybody. I got the same bonus as a person packing boxes or building a product or engineering a product. By the end of the year, we had given out in bonuses more than we would have done if we would have given 5% pay raises. So they did well by the risk they took, and we didn't lose a single person. And if you look at the names of the people who were employed in 1992, I guess, a surprising number of them are still with us. And that's also when I started to realize that the biggest asset we have isn't our technology. It isn't where we live. It's the people we have.
It's been a long run. And we're hoping, we know that there are a lot of entrepreneurs listening to this. So the question is, what was the hardest part of this? And what would you tell other people to pay attention to as they find themselves in the same growing environment?
The hardest part is actually, in my mind, the most satisfying part, which is creating a company or an environment where now 1,000 people can explore their passion and share whatever their particular passion is, they can contribute towards a cause that they care about. And the understanding the importance of the people of the company, I think, is critical. You know, I went in with a really arrogant mistaken concept that we built computers in Wisconsin and we have this great Midwest work ethic and we don't need people who just build dimmers. And it was arrogant and stupid. And once we realized this was the case, by 3 or 4 months into the transition, Dick Titus, who's now our president, was our vice president of manufacturing, came into the office where I was in Rochester and said, Fred, we've made a big mistake. We need these people. So we just changed our attitude and started bringing kids making minimum wage out to Wisconsin and relocated about 25 people, and more than half of those were in the direct labor group that I erroneously didn't think we needed. And now those people, 20 years into it, there were still 16 of the 25 people working for us, and they had become quality managers and stepped up in ways that I never would have thought. So starting to understand the value of the people, not the product, not the technology, I think was a big turning point for me.
And you had said earlier that you had asked Bob Gilson for financing advice when you were trying to do this acquisition. You know, in that situation today, there are a lot of entrepreneurs that ask for advice and then do the opposite. How did you manage to sort out knowing when to ask for advice and what advice to pay attention to?
Oh, people have never been shy to give me advice, and sometimes I listen and sometimes I don't.
And how do you decide when is which?
I don't know, and I don't think I decide correctly all the time. It turns out to be really important for me to have people question what I say, because if the company just acted on every harebrained idea I had, we would have disappeared a long time ago. So the idea of having people question and converse and discuss what we should be doing is critical for me. You know, I look at my decision. People think I'm autocratic, and I probably am much more autocratic than I want to admit. But the best way I can describe how I come up with a decision is I hear an idea, typically hear an idea or think of an idea that makes sense. And it's like I blow up a balloon and I find the first person who can comment on it, and I take it and say, hey, what do you think about this? And with the poke of one question, they pop the balloon. I said, So I go back and I patch the balloon in my mind and I find it, blow it up and take it to the next person. So it's this perverse form of consensus building. But by the time the balloon finally holds air, I hold it up and say, this is what we should do. And I see the collaboration. I'm not sure anybody else does. But that questioning is a big part of it, is to be able to listen and admit that I'm wrong or that there's a better idea.
Fred Foster, it's been a pleasure figuring out how did you do that.
Well, as soon as I know how I did that, I'll give you a better answer.
Hey, thanks, Fred.
Yep.
You can read more about Fred Foster's story and suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That at WUWM.com.
And be sure and listen to our other podcasts, which you can get at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.